we definitely are seeing more people hanging on by their fingernails.
A stark picture of Alaska's hunger problem. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 3rd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Yukon River fishermen criticize a new regulation.
This conservation measure is going to do a lot of harm, although it has good intentions behind it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846, press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
The Obama administration has finished a review of missile defense that includes plans for Fort Greely in Delta Junction. The first ever ballistic missile defense review was made public this week. It offers no surprises and continues the administration's current direction. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Democrat Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, welcomed its completion.
This is the first comprehensive policy and strategy framework for missile defense, and it is long overdue.
Levin criticized the Bush administration for not testing missile defense more thoroughly before deploying it. The new report calls for rigorous testing and says back in 2002, the program was put into place at the same time as it was developed in order to install it quickly. But the Obama administration says it wants to have more research under its belt before spending money to prevent waste. Last year, President Obama called for cuts to missile defense spending and proposed scrapping completion of a second missile field at Fort Greely, but Alaska's delegation was able to convince the administration to change its mind. It is moving forward on completing Field 2, and the new report affirms that plan. Defense Secretary Robert Gates assured Senator Mark Begich yesterday that the budget includes funding for the project. However, the Defense Department says it does not currently foresee a need for more deployed interceptors at Fort Greely beyond that. A new report is painting a bleak picture of Alaska's hunger problem. The study shows 74,000 people in Alaska receive food aid each year. That includes 31,000 children. The report, called The Hunger in America 2010, is released every 4 years and includes extensive demographic data on the problem in each state. Susanna Morgan is executive director of the Food Bank of Alaska. She says the new study shows about 12% of Alaska's population needs food assistance.
I think that in general, as Alaskans, we don't have a sense of the scope of this as a problem. I think that when we think of hunger, we think of the guy on the street corner with the "I will work for food" sign, and that this problem is 10 times larger than the problem of homelessness is something that I think we all grapple with getting our heads around. We commissioned an Anchorage subsection of this report just to get Anchorage numbers as well, and the Anchorage numbers were 41,200 people served annually just here in Anchorage, so that was about a third larger than I thought it was, and if anyone should guess, it should be able to be me. So just being surprised by the scope, even me who does this professionally, I think should be really sort of shocking to everyone else.
How does that compare with the previous report? Were the numbers similar?
We didn't have an Anchorage version for the previous report, and yes, the numbers were similar, within margin of error in terms of the scope for the state. I think I was a little bit surprised that we weren't seeing more people, but we think that we are, although we have no data, this is just my gut saying that we're seeing people more often.
And nearly half of the respondents reported having to choose between buying food and paying their rent or mortgage. Has this changed much from the previous study?
Yes. Went up from about 30% to now, which is one of the reasons why I think it's the depth of the problem. The breadth may be about the same, but the depth is much worse. Nearly half of folks were reporting having unpaid medical bills or not seeking medical assistance because they didn't have insurance. We definitely are seeing more people hanging on by their fingernails.
We've heard a lot nationally about people who used to have good jobs having to rely now on the food bank. Is that also a trend that you're seeing in Alaska?
Well, it's interesting. I follow the economic news in Alaska very carefully, and it's generally been positive and said that we aren't suffering the same kind of economic damage in Alaska that that the rest of the country is seeing, although it started to slump in about September with the railroad layoffs. And I'm looking at this going, this isn't my reality, because the number of people showing up at food pantries and the amount of assistance that was being required shot up 2 years ago. That said, the study also found that the average household income for clients was $15,090. Average household income absolutely just staggered me. I didn't believe that people could live on that kind of money in this state. And 46% of those are employed. I do think there is an underclass to the Alaskan society that we often don't see and don't recognize.
Does Alaska fit in with trends that food banks are seeing nationwide?
Yeah, we do. That there's more need for food assistance, that it tends to be more and more working folks and families, children and elders, and that the smaller percentage of single homeless adults. I would say that Alaska tends to be incredibly unique in our transportation challenges when it comes to trying to solve the problem. But there are also ways in which it is a benefit to us. For instance, Alaska is about average, a little bit better than average, in providing food stamps to our population. And the rural areas are better than the urban areas, because in the rural areas, they're small, and you're likely to know the person who takes food stamp applications. It's likely to be your cousin or your friend or your aunt. So we, in rural Alaska, it sometimes feels like we're able to use the community that's built out there to actually provide better assistance in that way, which is great. Since it costs so much for me to ship food, I'm doing a pretty lousy job at that. So I like to think of those as sort of offsetting challenges and benefits that we have here in Alaska.
Susanna Morgan is Executive Director of the Food Bank of Alaska. The House and Senate Education Committees today opened combined hearings on Governor Sean Parnell's Performance Scholarship Program. It is one of the governor's top priorities for this year's session. The proposed scholarship program would pay tuition expenses for students who take a required course of study, graduate with high grade averages, and who pass a standardized test. Supporting the proposal, James Kaye of the Taylor Foundation in New Orleans described the effects of a similar scholarship program in place in Louisiana. He said the goal of that state's program was to allow young people to experience the American dream. He said it's about education reform.
Every state, wherever the program was initiated, we've seen significant reform, significant improvements in ACT scores, in grade point averages, in preparation for college, in reduction in remedial offerings, in higher graduation rate at the universities, in parental involvement, probably the biggest of all. You know, where the parents get involved in the education with their kids in high school.
There has been concern among some lawmakers that the scholarship program is not based on the needs of the students' families. But Bill Schilling of the Wyoming Business Association told members that the scholarship program in his state, similar to the Parnell plan, is income blind.
The program becomes a leveler because it treats all kids in a similar fashion. They all get the opportunity to earn. So it breaks down social distinctions, economic distinctions, what the parents do distinctions and all that. And the kids become their own peer group. I don't want to use the word pressure, but rather I think the better word is motivator.
The legislation would set aside $400 million as an income source for the scholarships. It's not yet scheduled for further hearings. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cuisine for zoo bears.
There's actually an omnivore pellet that provides most of the nutrients that bears need, and it's something that they find very tasty.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
A recent decision by the Alaska Board of Fisheries is being criticized by fishermen on the lower Yukon River. The board says they're trying to rescue a dwindling stock of Chinook or king salmon. But fishermen in the most impoverished region of the state say the brunt of conservation efforts are again falling on their shoulders. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
There's a reason lower Yukon fishers use 8 or 8.5-inch mesh nets. They are extremely efficient at catching big Chinook salmon and avoiding smaller chums. But in 2011, 8-inch gear and anything bigger will become illegal on the Yukon for commercial and subsistence fishers. That's after a recent vote by the Alaska Board of Fisheries to set a mesh limit of 7.5 inches. John Linderman, the regional supervisor for Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim commercial fisheries, says the move could protect bigger, older salmon, which are thought to be superior reproducers.
A large female king salmon is going to carry more eggs than a smaller female king salmon. And there's also some potential benefits in the way of production, that larger king salmon, their eggs usually carry more proteins, which may help to affect survival of the fry as they emerge from the gravel the following spring.
Not only are fewer kings returning to the Yukon, Linderman says there's evidence that over the last 40 years, fewer big fish are returning.
The biggest decrease in Chinook salmon was in 7-year-old male king salmon. The other thing that's a part of this, too, is that historically there was 8-year-old king salmon on the Yukon, always very, very small proportions, a very, very tiny fraction of the entire run was in that 8-year-old age class. And over time, we have not seen those 8-year-olds.
Linderman says that a 3-year mesh size test shows that 7.5-inch gear will harvest salmon in percentages that almost mirror the age, sex, and species composition of the Yukon run. That would make it more difficult to target just the desirable and oil-rich kings. But not everyone agrees that the move to smaller nets will be effective.
This conservation measure is going to do a lot of harm, although it has good intentions behind it.
Nick Andrew Jr. is a lower Yukon fisherman and director of the Ohagamut Traditional Council.
We are going to be maiming and killing medium to large size king salmon in our efforts to conserve them.
Those against large mesh restrictions argue that bigger fish may be able to escape from smaller nets, but they can still receive injuries that prevent them from reaching their spawning grounds. The scientific term is called dropout, and it's notoriously difficult to study. Linderman says a 3-year dropout study conducted in the Bristol Bay region came back with inconclusive results. But one effect will be undeniable. Restricting large gear will be expensive for fishers. Again, Nick Andrew Jr.
A lot of people don't have the means to buy new gear, and this is attacking the most vulnerable. It's we, the subsistence users out here in the village, in this already crippled economy in the lower Yukon River.
The lower Yukon region has the lowest per capita income of anywhere in the state and the highest unemployment rate. The 2008-2009 commercial fisheries there were recently declared fisheries disasters by the U.S. Commerce Department. That opens the way for Congress to appropriate funding for affected commercial fishers there. But Andrew says the benefits of that won't be realized if those same fishers have to spend upwards of $1,000 on new gear to comply with the new law.
It is ironic that the federal government is finally, after years of beckoning for a federal fishery disaster that's coming through, we're just requesting either the government, if they're so adamant on conserving salmon stocks, is to furnish people with nets.
Linderman says the board was aware and concerned about the financial hardships their actions would cause for Yukon fishers, but he says they think it's the lesser of two evils.
They felt that there may be even more sacrifice and hardship, that if actions, conservation measures, such as a mesh size restriction weren't taking, that if they started to continue to see these declines, not only in size of fish, but also the general decline that we've been seeing in the overall runs in recent years, that that's an additional hardship, that an initial sacrifice from an economic perspective may help to try and address.
The move towards small gear is not uniformly opposed by community along the river. The Interior Regional Advisory Committee and three other advisory committees wanted the board to implement an even stricter 6-inch limit on mesh size. The Board of Fisheries met last weekend in Fairbanks to take action on proposals concerning the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim fisheries. That meeting occurs once every 3 years. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
State Senator Albert Kukesh came under fire recently for remarks he made in Craig. Remarks Kukesh made during a city council meeting were perceived by some as a threat that Kukesh would withhold support for Craig projects if the city council expressed opposition to Sea Alaska land selection legislation. Kukesh is also chairman of the Sea Alaska Board of Directors, and the federal legislation would allow the Native Corporation to harvest timber from new areas of Prince of Wales Island. After Kukesh made his remarks, Sitka Assemblymember Jack Osment was quoted in two newspapers saying that Kukesh made similar remarks to the Sitka Assembly during a meeting 2 years ago. He made those remarks in a meeting held on February 26, 2008. The Assembly was considering a resolution opposing the Sea Alaska bill.
None of us who live in Southeast Alaska do anything in a vacuum. Everything that we do affects somebody. Let me give you some examples. While I'm not serving as the Sea Alaska Board, I'm also a state senator. And as a state senator, I've done a number of things that benefit Sitka. And I just want to remind you of it because I'm an Alaska native and I'm doing good things for Sitka. One of them is every year I vote on the Mount Edgecombe budget. And I was here, and I'm a graduate of Mount Edgecombe, when it closed. And I saw the impact it had on Sitka. And I was one of the driving force individuals in the Alaska Native community who worked very hard to get Mount Edgecombe High School to open again. And I'm very supportive of Mount Edgecombe High School. And I think the worst thing that could happen to Sitka, other than a pulp mill, was to have Mount Edgecombe leave again. Because I came here as an individual after that and saw what happened to this community. I'm also a member of the majority in the Alaska Legislature with Senator Stedman. And the discussion about the cruise ship tax is a valid one. And I sit as a member of that organization that's going to help decide those taxes. And I think that Sitka's going to benefit and do very well with the cruise tax initiative and with the impact of this community.
Kukesh went on to express concern about population loss in Southeast Alaska, especially in villages. He said expanding Sea Alaska's ability to do business in the region would be an economic benefit to the area and help create jobs. About 4.5 minutes into his testimony, he went back to clarify comments he made about his position in the state Senate.
I also want to make a clarification point. I'm a state legislator. I'm a member of the state Senate. Those comments I made about helping Sitka are the same comments I would make to any community in Southeast Alaska. I would not, no matter what you do on this resolution, do anything to hurt Sitka. I've got family members and a lot of cousins and relatives who live here. So my commitment, of course, is to Southeast Alaska.
State Senator Albert Kukesh speaking at a Sitka Assembly meeting in 2008.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
three brown bear cubs orphaned last summer in Sitka have a new home in New York City. The Bronx Zoo last week displayed Sitka, Coots, and Denali to the public for the first time. A fourth orphaned cub from Montana shares an adjacent habitat and will join the Alaska Bears once they all get to know each other. The zoo's parent organization, the Wildlife Conservation Society, hopes these new urban bears help spread the message about protecting wild habitat. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The final destination of the Sitka cubs has been under wraps ever since last October, when three large empty crates labeled Bronx Zoo arrived at the Sitka airport. Well, so much for secrecy. The bears were safely shipped cross-country, quarantined for disease and parasites, and slowly introduced to their new home in the heart of one of the country's busiest metropolitan areas. Sitka, Coots, and Denali apparently have adjusted, and now it's time to roll cameras. This is from television station New York One.
Well, the Bronx Zoo gets some furry new residents. Four orphan cubs are now part of the zoo's family. The Wildlife Conservation Society says three of the cubs are brown bear siblings rescued by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
I'm just so excited. I'm so excited for the Bronx Zoo to have the opportunity to have those cubs.
Christine Fenwick is the former bear supervisor at Fortress of the Bear in Sitka, the nonprofit organization which assisted the Department of Fish and Game and the Bronx Zoo in the transfer of the cubs.
And the Bronx Zoo is an amazing facility. I have connections with some of the keepers that work closely with that facility, and I know they're getting some of the best care that they could possibly get in a captive facility.
The bears live in an exhibit about three-quarters of an acre in size, with boulders, pools, and a flowing stream. Glacier, the Montana cub, is right next door, but he is a year older, and zoo officials are going to let the Alaska cubs catch up in size before everyone shares the same space. Pat Thomas is the general curator at the Bronx Zoo. He says the bears were given plenty of time to get used to their new home before their official coming out.
We let the bears tell us how long it'll take them to be comfortable in the exhibit. And initially we do it when the zoo's not open so they don't have to deal with distractions from the public. It's a lot more quiet. And just over time we gradually increase the amount of time they spend on exhibit. And when they're ready, we debut them to the public.
The Wildlife Conservation Society operates five facilities. In addition to the Bronx Zoo, there's the Central and Prospect Park Zoos, the Queens Zoo, and the New York Aquarium. The bears could live into their late teens. During their brief captivity in Sitka, the Fortress of the Bear combed grocery stores for leftover produce to feed them. Thomas says the Bronx Zoo has a longer-term strategy for feeding animals that could eventually weigh in at over 1,000 pounds.
Believe it or not, there are companies that make bear chow the way companies make dog chow. So there's an omnivore pellet that provides most of the nutrients that bears need, and it's something that they find very tasty. And then we supplement that diet with fruits and vegetables and fish.
Sitka, Coots, and Denali were captured last August by the Department of Fish and Game after their mother disappeared. She and her four cubs at the time had spent most of the summer enjoying the lush berry crop and raiding garbage cans in Sitka neighborhoods. The sow's carcass was later found and necropsied. She had been fatally wounded by the rubber projectiles fired by law enforcement officers to haze her out of populated areas. The fourth cub died in the rescue attempt. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
This weekend, the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage hosts its annual Indigenous World Film Festival. And this year, a new event takes place on Thursday evening, featuring films created by Canadian and Alaska Native youth. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The two latest big-screen horror films set in Alaska proved disappointing for residents seeking local flavor. The 2007 film 30 Days of Night, shot in New Zealand, featured a vampire-stuffed barrow with a seasonally closed airport and only two Alaska natives in the main cast. Well, two sort of natives. 2009's The Fourth Kind, mostly filmed in British Columbia and Bulgaria, depicted an alien-afflicted gnome sporting trees, high mountains, but no Alaska natives. However, Rise of the Zombies, directed by Athena Steinhelpert of South High School, and starring East High's Travis Mosquito as the zombie, presents a true Alaskan location and cast. Athena and Travis are members of the media group at the Alaska Native Heritage Center's after-school program. The media group decided to make a film they could show at Thursday evening's first-ever Youth Sector, a prelude to this weekend's Indigenous World Film Festival. Rise of the Zombies will be one of 18 productions by Canadian and Alaskan youth, varying in length from 30 seconds to several minutes. Athena explains the plot.
It's about this kid who, on a dare, ends up becoming a zombie somehow. I don't want to give it away. There's conflict between zombies and people who aren't zombies here in Anchorage, but I guess you could probably apply it to about anywhere in the world.
Well, provided the city had an Alaska Native Heritage Center, the setting, and Native dancers, the object of the zombies' attention. This is not the media group's first video production. They previously produced Cultural Jeopardy, which was shown over GCI's television outlet in Anchorage, KACN Channel 38.
We'd have a board made, and then there would be different categories. Each week we'd focus on a different culture. There'd be questions about, like, technology, society, like, just lifestyle sort of questions. A few of them had, like, sort of pre-contact and post-contact sort of related questions. Each week we'd sort of switch off, like one of us would be the host and then there'd be two contestants and another one of us would probably be working on the camera.
The group's coordinator, Kelly Gwynn, along with Athena and Travis, offered an impromptu sample.
Who we are for 100. The answer is Northwest Coast cultures use this kind of system in the organization of society.
What is clan?
The original homeland of this culture group is the Queen Charlotte Islands in British Columbia, Canada.
What is Haida?
The media group has also produced posters. Athena designed the Student Film Festival one. And a task board near Gwynn's desk shows upcoming newsletter assignments. And they also make future plans, which currently show a media group influence.
I was thinking about minoring in it in college, maybe, because I was going to focus on pre-medicine when I get there, but I was kind of considering this too.
I've been thinking about going to college for most likely an actor.
In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846, press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.